Good evening, it is 5pm and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After being in limbo since February, the Kingston School of Art has announced that they officially have a new home. KSOA made the difficult decision to move from their location of 31 years at the corner of Princess Street and Victoria Street earlier this year. But later this month, KSOA will be joining Providence Village. Located at 1200 Princess Street, the charitable organization brings together diverse community partners to offer services to people across the region. Some of the partners that call the village home include Girls Inc. Limestone, the Heart Center, Providence Care, the Alzheimer's Society, and Independent Living Center Kingston. This new chapter for KSOA will include a dedicated printmaking studio with professional presses, flexible multi-purpose classrooms for arts programming, increased accessibility, and collaboration with the village's vibrant community of nonprofits. KSOA's treasurer and longtime board member, Rob Hosier, sat down with CFRC to chat about the upcoming move.
Last time we chatted with KSOA, things were quite up in the air. I was wondering if you could just give us the full story of how this partnership with Providence Village came to be and how we ended up here where you're ready to move in at the end of September.
Oh my gosh, Providence Village was perfect. It's just that perfect timing that you never get in working with nonprofit organizations. It seems like we're always scrambling, but really we loved our old location. That's like a fact. We had an amazing landlord. We had an amazing location. But you know, there was a few drawbacks to it in a sense as well. We had limited accessibility and we had limited parking. And as a lot of nonprofits over the pandemic, you start reassessing where your resources go and things like that. And so we were kind of going through a change where we were re-scoping how we served our community and making sure that we weren't duplicating services and going through an internal kind of assessment. In that assessment, we determined that this nice big space, which I'm sure is going to be utilized for something incredible afterwards, isn't necessarily suiting our needs for what we need to provide for the community. And so we looked and looked and looked and looked and looked, and then Providence Village comes to us and says, hey, you know, we've got space in our organization, our village that may suit KSOA. And they came to us in the purest sense of community. They're looking for community partners to be in a little community to serve the bigger community, which it's like layers of community. And so when when that proposition came to the table, we were like, it's a no brainer at this point. It's an incredible opportunity. It increases our accessibility, increases our parking, increases our space, increases everything that we can do to equitably provide arts to our community without breaking the bank.
Absolutely. And you kind of dove into this a bit there, but it sounds like this new space is adding a lot for KSOA. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about this location.
There's a major issue and there's so much potential. And so it's amazing opportunity. So what we're excited about is, like, number one, what I said is that we're entering into an existing community that already has, people that already are populating the village with community-facing services and different organizations that even that alone could keep us busy for the next 5 or 6 years, if not more. But on top of that, just the resources and the connections and the accessibility and just the opportunity to increase our footprint at Providence Village. The outdoors around Providence Village is just incredible, the outdoor space. And so when we start considering reinstating summer camps and spring break camps and, you know, art camps, plein air painting events and things like that, things like we can take art to the outdoors. We're unparalleled for space in that. So, you know, it's literally that thing where we have so much opportunity and they've been so amazing to work with and providing us opportunities, providing us ideas on how we can engage with their community and the existing community at large. It's just been amazing.
That's awesome. And this is kind of jumping around a bit, but it just came to mind. Last time I spoke with Christiane, everything was really up in the air. They didn't know where all the supplies were going. I was wondering, where has everything been in the meantime? Did folks take it home?
In a large storage unit. We actually slimmed down. We had 31 years in that last location. So as you can understand, being a volunteer-led organization, things start to collect after a while, and maybe not in the best ways. And things. So we had a massive clean out. Our team and our board and a few other folks came, and we spent literally weeks going through all of our old art, you know, salvaging what we could salvage, and literally selling everything that we didn't need at the time. And so we focused on the education system and teachers that need supplies for their classrooms and such. And then it got to the point where it's just like, come in, grab what you need and go, just making sure that we were just not wasting those particular resources. But from then on in, we have these massive printing presses because we have printmakers. We're literally one of the only ones. I don't know as far as region goes, but we're at least the only ones in the region with full printmaking equipment and things. So you have these massive printmaking pieces of equipment and things like that. They've all been in storage for now while we custom fit up our space in Providence Village. And so we have a few spaces in Providence Village that we're going to do some core printmaking and things like that, but also open up the other classroom, open up some other classrooms for some art programming. But all that stuff has been storage. We're literally moving that stuff in later on this month because we had to accommodate for these big, massive printmaking machines, and Providence Village has been amazing with us trying to get these things in there. But yeah, it's literally in storage, going back in, and now we're organizing the space to provide a core printmaking studio and then start setting up our classrooms. So that exciting work happens this end of this month, I believe. And so we can have hopefully some courses going up in fall.
Awesome. And what's kind of the energy of your team right now? You guys are all kind of getting ready to move and slowly ramp up programming. How's it going?
We did some strategic planning not too long ago. We're so excited, but a little bit exhausted. So if we're a volunteer run board, there's less than 10 of us that are doing this. And so on our ksoa.info, if you'd like to volunteer or help or support or anything like that, just shoot us a line there. We'd appreciate the help. But we are so excited. We definitely are in such a state of transition right now. And so we're trying to also, you know, put our mission and what we want to accomplish in our community really, really, you know, forward and really focus on that, in the sense that we are now downsizing and we're now have the opportunity to really change our model up quite severely. So we've been throwing around ideas like shared spaces models, where we go into the community with like a kit of things that we could do within that classroom space, or that church basement, or that Rideau Heights Community Center, or Boys and Girls Club, or whatever the case may be. And so there's a lot of possibility right now, but we're really trying to start and get a firm foothold with the printmakers, and then the on-premises studios to start up a few classes as kind of our bedrock, and then start being creative from there on in.
Once again, that was Rob Hosier, board member with the Kingston School of Art, on their upcoming move to their new home at Providence Village later this month. NAV Canada has broken ground on the country's first ever digital air traffic facility right here in Kingston. This temporary site will serve as the foundation for next-generation air navigation technologies before a permanent digital hub is established in the city. David Shepherd, NAV Canada's Vice President and Chief Technology Officer, explained in an interview with CFRC how Kingston's new facility will transform the current air traffic control model.
Yeah, it's very different in terms of the nature around how the services are going to be provided forward. Today, we have staff that work actually physically at a location in a physical building looking at windows. Tomorrow, with this technology, the introduction of this technology, we'll be bringing in state-of-the-art cameras, equipment that will and high-speed networks that will bring in a video feed and simulate the out-the-window view onto a screen that can be independent of the location of where the service is provided from. And the technology that's available actually also includes significant improvements from what's available from out the human eye. So things like digital overlays, or you can see surveillance, automatic detection tracking, that all improves the safety environment for our employees and for the aviation community.
So why Kingston? Shepherd says a combination of factors made the city an ideal fit.
We ended up looking across the country to determine where we thought would make most sense to start trialing this technology and our first digital hub as well. And we ended up narrowing in within a region of a number of different cities. And Kingston was looked at for a number of different factors on three categories, work, live, and play. And it really was looking at it from an employee's perspective around the quality of life, not just at the work environment, but for their family and for themselves in terms of the city that they're living in. And so Kingston came out amongst the top within the region that we were looking for. In addition, it's got proximity to Ottawa, which is an important element, particularly for this first site, for our technical teams to go there and our operational teams to go there to trial the technology, but also the regulator, which is Transport Canada, to be part of the process as well and be able to hop in a car and go down to Kingston and see the technology as it's evolving to ensure that they're confident in the solution and the capabilities as well.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of got into it a bit there, but what does this mean for the city and our residents? What kind of opportunities will this bring?
So there's a number of opportunities that are going to pop up. One is just trialing the technology. So there is investment that's going in to Kingston even right now with this announcement. You'll see we're starting a fairly significant construction project to build out and expand the existing tower that's at the Kingston Airport to accommodate this digital facility. It also will mean a number of different jobs that will move into Kingston as well in terms of providing our traffic services. We've also just relocated a couple of technologists as well that lead there. So these are great jobs, and it's a great city, and so it would be a significant amount of opportunity for the city of Kingston.
The Kingston site is part of NAV Canada's broader Digital Aerodrome Air Traffic Services Initiative, joining a global shift already underway in 16 other countries.
Yes, so we end up looking across the globe, really, to see who is doing what in air traffic control services using these digital facilities. And there's a number of really interesting models that are out there. One is in London City, where they end up remoting in a very busy airport into Swanwick, so it's the southern part of the UK. And the other one was in Norway, where there was a digital hub concept that we end up seeing, which was where we think the future is, where it's not just about moving single airports, it's looking at this much more holistically as an organization around how we can move multiple airports into a single location so that we can provide more staffing flexibility. We can concentrate sort of the technology investments in the future as well. And so looking at those models, we ended up mirroring ours off of the Norway model.
The permanent hub in Kingston is expected to be up and running in the early 2030s and will eventually host remote services for up to 20 airports.
Yeah, it's all dependent on how the technology evolves and getting through a number of stages of approvals for ourselves to make sure we're confident that the safety case behind it, the technology is functioning, and our operational staff are able to use it appropriately, and making sure our regulator with Transport Canada is also confident in the capabilities that we've demonstrated along the way. So there's a number of gates that we're moving along, but the more permanent solution is we're looking in the early 2030s. For us working towards that. But we're starting with Kingston at the Kingston Airport, and then we'll be adding one additional airport to trial out the remote capabilities within the next few years associated with that. And then after that, that's where we start building up the digital hub and scaling that up.
For now, Kingston will lead the way in testing Canada's aviation future. For CFRC News, I'm Christina Laurie, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, September 15th, daytime high of 23 degrees with largely sunny conditions here in the city of Kingston, dropping down to 12 overnight. Tuesday, September 16th, daytime high of 25 with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 12 overnight once more. Wednesday, September 17th, a little cooler with a high of 23, but with all the beautiful sunshine, it's going to to feel closer to 26, and it will be a little warmer overnight with a overnight low of just 15 degrees. Thursday, September 18th, daytime high of 24, another beautiful sunny day. Friday, September 19th, 20 in the day, but it is dropping down to sub double digits, 8 degrees overnight. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, September 20th, daytime high of 16 with an overnight low of 8, sunny conditions. And Sunday, September 21st, daytime high of 17 with a lot of cloud coverage, dropping down to an overnight low of 9. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. We will focus on road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen 2 Colborn, closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl Street, Collingwood 2 Toronto, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Johnson Street at Victoria, closed September 15th to 26th for sewer separation and road rehabilitation. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, is closed until October 10th for a gas main installation. Lincoln Drive at Bay Ridge is closed until September 19th for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Montreal Street at Railway and Rideau is closed September 18th at 11 p.m. to the following morning at 6 a.m. to accommodate a paving operation. Princess Street at Taylor Kidd and John Counter is closed September 17th at 11 p.m. to the next morning at 6 a.m. to accommodate a paving operation. And Sydenham Street, Princess 2 Queen, is closed until October 24th for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, is also closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Seth W.J. Hunt's new album, Almost Famous, Almost 25, a collection of songs about heartbreak, anxiety, and the search for self-worth. Written in New York City and recorded in Kingston, the album tells stories of love, loss, and trying to find where you fit in. The music is honest and melodic, blending raw emotion with classic influences from The Strokes, Ryan Adams, The Cure, Oasis, and The Beatles. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Almost Famous, Almost 25 by Seth W.J. Hunt on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it now called Lose My Head with us here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I think I like this light. I think you like it too. Sit in the park, people watching, I'll talk shit to you. Sunsets are getting lonely, sunsets are getting dull, but you're still here beside me, so I'll cherish everyone I know. They're thinking about my drinking, say I need to cool it or you're gonna lose it, and I laugh. You and I will enjoy these times. While the songs play by the grateful
That guy is probably right. From all the times I snuck into your house late at night. Your mother says she loves me. I know she really does. Put on our favorite songs and burn down the neighborhood. You and I enjoy these times before I go and lose my head. While the songs play by the Grateful Dead. You and I see the skyline, and now we're getting in my bed. And I promise you I'll try not to lose my head. Enjoy these times before I go and lose my head. While the songs play by the Grateful Dead. You and I see the skyline, and now we're getting in my bed. And I'll promise you
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from local jazz musician Oscar Evans' latest work, Live at Hotel Wolf Island. The album is a live recording from a quartet performance featuring Jonathan Stewart on saxophone, Nick Kornelik on piano, Andy Love on drums, and Oscar Evans on upright bass. Recorded in front of a live audience in March 2025, the album is a stellar example of Oscar's musicianship as a band leader and upright bassist. Follow Oscar on Instagram at Oscar Mayfield Evans for upcoming releases and exciting performance announcements. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Live at Wolf Island by Oscar Evans on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called I Mean You with us now here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We'll be right back.
day, you're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 282, and I'm Stefan Christoph. Thank you so much for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with Isabeau Doucette, who is a reporter that works with The Guardian and a number of other media outlets based in the Bay Area of San Francisco. Isabeau has worked on an important recent series for The Guardian that speaks to the realities of immigration, customs enforcement, ICE policies right now in the United States, and how that intersects with the Palestinian experience. Isabeau talks about the sort of legal quagmire that a number of Palestinian migrants have faced within the U.S. A lot of this comes from the fact that the United States does not recognize Palestine, and so that creates legal limbo reality of statelessness. And of course, we're talking about contexts where Palestinians are claiming asylum as stateless people. And I think this is really an interesting window on the intersections of the war on Palestine as we're seeing play out in Gaza and beyond, and how that intersects with individual experiences in the United States in relation to migration and immigration. So here's my conversation with Isabeau Doucette for Free City Radio. Often media coverage about Gaza becomes very focused in a way that portrays the genocide taking place as occurring in, you know, one geographic location, without sort of pointing to the ways that, of course, money, material, human beings move, and there's a lot of connections to people in Gaza all around the world, but also, of course, there's a lot of material relationships. Isabeau, your stories and reporting have spoken to the ways that migrant justice and Palestine are connected, and also, I think, illustrated in a meaningful way the ways that if we think about Palestine, we're also thinking about the world. And I think that opens up a lot of points for a conversation. So maybe you could first introduce yourself and expand on any of that.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Stefan. My name is Isabeau Doucette, and I'm a freelance journalist, and I've been writing some pieces about Palestinians, especially in the U.S. and or trying to get to the U.S. For The Guardian. And I spent kind of weeks, months interviewing Palestinians who had fled Gaza and were trying to seek safety elsewhere. And I found some, you know, really kind of just impossible situations that many of them felt, many of them faced. I don't think a lot of people realize the unique situations that the situation that Palestinians face in the international refugee system. Like, they're one of the largest groups of refugees in the world, and yet they're largely excluded from the international refugee system as it currently exists. And so they're kind of stuck in this state of limbo. They can't return, but they can't also go on, or they can't go on and, you know, seek safety in other countries in the same way that other populations have been able to, because they're excluded from the UNHCR, the international refugee system that was established after 1948. And then how this, you know, impacts on the ground in the U.S. is also very unique. They have been completely erased from even being able to be considered refugees or asylum seekers as Palestinians. Through my reporting, I found that, you know, despite the overwhelming violence that they face from the state of Israel, the U.S. does not recognize, I guess, doesn't recognize the existence of a Palestinian state. So, you know, categorizes Palestinian asylum seekers as from an unknown country, or categorizes, like, requires them to, even if they're seeking asylum, be registered as from, you know, a neighboring country like Jordan or Egypt or Syria or Lebanon, even if they've, like, barely ever been to that country. So I interviewed this young man, Ali Al-Jamal, who had come here in September of 2023 to study as part of a State Department exchange program called the YES program. And he was supposed to just be here for a year, but the war broke out, like, as soon as he left. And the State Department, you know, would not help them, him and his other YES Gaza student exchange students from Gaza seek asylum or find any way of extending their student visas. So he decided to file for asylum. And when he went to register with USCIS, you know, they asked him to fill out a form like, what is your country of origin? And he put, you know, Palestine, Gaza, where were you born? You know, Gaza again. And they were like, no, sorry, we don't recognize Palestine. Just put Jordan instead. And I just thought that was so incredible. This kid is trying to seek asylum because of the, you know, the horrific levels of violence back in Gaza. And he's not even allowed to be considered, like, Palestinian, even though that's, you know, the group that's being targeted. Even while trying to claim asylum, his Palestinian identity, the facts of his persecution, the facts of where he was born are erased, are not enterable in the asylum system, that he has to, like, lie, basically, and say that he's from Jordan, a country he briefly passed through on his way to Gaza, even though credibility is crucial in any kind of asylum claim. You're not supposed to lie on an asylum application. And here you have this situation where the government is basically telling him, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to lie, or you're going to have to say that you're from this other country. Looking into this, you know, through Freedom of Information requests, found, like, there's even a 2018 memo from USCIS, U.S. Citizens and Immigration Services, basically outlining what the rules are, that you can only put Palestine as a country of origin on any kind of immigration application if you were born there before 1948. And so, you know, this has, like, ripple effects for so many different people. I also spoke to this professor in Michigan who was born in what is now Israel, and he, when he became a U.S. citizen, had managed to tell the USCIS officer, you know, to put his country of birth down as Palestine, even though he was born in 1949. The person who issued him his citizenship, you know, didn't know the sort of 1948, 1949. You know, it got slipped through the system. And this meant that he was able to, for all of his life, visit his friends and family who lived in Lebanon, because his passport said that he was born in Palestine. But under Biden a couple of years ago, when he went to renew his passport, it, you know, somehow something got jammed in the system and his application took months to process. And finally, when he got his passport back, it suddenly said he was born in Israel, and that meant that he is no longer able to travel to visit his family and friends in Lebanon. His mother was born in Lebanon. So there are all these little kind of, it seems so small, you know, and technical, but it has, like, these real huge ramifications for people. And I just think it's really not well understood, just this kind of position, this like limbo that Palestinians have been in for generations now. And then this erasure, I guess one of the questions that I was trying to find out, and I, you know, I must have emailed like a dozen, you know, scholars and lawyers and people, and I still haven't actually quite gotten an answer. But one of the things that a lot of the attorneys, the immigration attorneys I spoke to, said was that Palestinians face a higher burden of proof when trying to seek asylum. And often they have to prove persecution by someone other than the state of Israel in order to qualify, meaning that, you know, they have to be, I don't know, LGBTQ, or, you know, have converted from one religion to another, and or be somehow persecuted by the Palestinian Authority or someone other than the state of Israel in order to qualify for asylum in the U.S. And likewise, for refugee status, you know, it's very, very difficult for Palestinians in Gaza or in Palestine to qualify as refugees. Often they actually have to flee to a third country, to a different country, and apply as refugees from there. But again, they can only qualify if they are claiming persecution by someone other than Israel. And I was trying to think, well, why is this? You know, like, is this just, you know, is this just that the U.S. is politically disinclined to recognize persecution by an ally? I mean, yes, obviously. But is there maybe also a legal reason? And this is something that I'm still kind of looking into. Like, would it trigger something legally for the U.S. to be admitting refugees who are being persecuted by a U.S. ally and by, you know, U.S. supplied weapons? Like, you know, is there something in U.S. law that would somehow be triggered and require, you know, some sort of consequence for the U.S. Israel alliance, you know, if they were admitting all these refugees from a country that the U.S. itself was causing? I'm not sure. I mean, it's like it's not unique to Palestine either. There's lots of countries in Latin America who have had U.S. coups and U.S. supplied weapons causing people to flee. But yeah, I just think it's an interesting question if it's kind of legal ass covering on the part of the U.S. to refuse to recognize any kind of Israeli state violence.
Thanks for sharing all that, Izibo. There's a lot to look into. I think that what you've shared speaks to the administrative elements of violence that often Palestinians face, which I think the narratives really focus on militarized violence, which of course is important to focus on. But then on an international level, there's all this administrative violence, which often is processed through the context of people trying to achieve status. It brings up, I think, a mirroring in different ways around how to understand interconnections of an anti-war movement, or a movement to stand with Palestine, and migrant justice, because there are connections. But let's say for reporting at this moment, when there's a lot of protest of Trump's attacks on migrant rights, there isn't an inherent connection made. But I think it's an important topic to explore. So what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many interconnections. And I think that the bureaucratic side of things is something that, you know, people's eyes slightly glaze over because it is kind of tedious, the language and just the sort of the Kafkaesque kind of nightmare situations people are faced with. But that is very much violence. you know, like right now there are people who came to the U.S. under Biden and went through, you know, the system as it existed at that time. And, you know, we're here kind of waiting for asylum or, you know, legally, and are now just being rounded up and disappeared for all intents and purposes.
Thanks for sharing that. It's important to underline. Can you talk about why you dug into these particular stories as a journalist and as a reporter? You know, there is, of course, an increasing focus on lifting up Palestinian voice and speaking to, you know, how that plays out in terms of everything from listening to Palestinians talking about their own experience in Gaza or Palestinian experiences outside. But the context is that there are millions of Palestinian experiences, the vast majority of which are within contexts where the capacity to articulate and access outlets is deeply restricted due to resources, due to colonialism, due to enclosure, occupation, many other contexts. And I think that this brings up an important question around thinking about why it's important that people still stand up with Palestinians and make the effort to report and share these types of stories. I think that people can get a bit lost in sort of like a certain type of discourse that would remove the capacity for people to lift up the stories like the ones that you've reported, which are obviously ones that are important to know about.
Yeah, so I got into this, I mean, I think just on a personal note, I have, you know, dealt with some, you know, immigration, kind of being stuck in an immigration abyss. You know, I had two passports stolen once while I was heavily pregnant and ended up having to go back to Canada in order to get a new visa. And then the U.S. government accidentally canceled the new visa that they had just issued me instead of the one that was in the stolen passport, and linked my brand new passport in their system as having been stolen instead of the stolen one. And that caused huge complications for me on a personal level. So I think, you know, I'm just kind of interested in these like situations where people are, you know, through no fault of their own, stuck in a kind of Kafkaesque situation. And I think Palestinians are, you know, really you know, at the front of the queue in terms of this kind of nightmarish, you know, bureaucratic citizen hellscape. In terms of why I focused on U.S. immigration, I'm based in California, and I was, you know, working with an editor at The Guardian, and she could, you know, she's in New York and, you know, could only really commission stories that have a U.S. angle, because obviously they have a whole team covering, you know, the Middle East. It wouldn't make sense to have a journalist in California, you know, writing about, you know, the war itself, even though no journalists can get into Gaza anyway. So whether you're in California or you're in Egypt, doesn't, I mean, obviously it makes a difference, but, you know, no one's actually on the ground other than the amazing journalists, brave journalists in Gaza. But yeah, I was focused on U.S. angles to what was happening for families trying to get their, you know, loved ones, for American citizens stuck in Gaza, trying to get out. And again, like that's also a whole other, you know, I spoke to a mother who was there living there with her son, her American son. And she had just gone to visit, but decided to stay because they were having such an amazing time reconnecting with family and just, you know, living just a quality of life in Gaza in terms of community that that she couldn't have in the U.S. And so she just decided to extend her stay, and their passports got expired. Their passports expired and she had to renew them. But being in Gaza, she wasn't able to get to the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. They just would not issue her a travel permit, even as a U.S. citizen, to travel from Gaza to Jerusalem. And their passports, you know, eventually she decided to go to Amman, Jordan. But this is only after like months of back and forth. And before she could go to Amman, the war broke out. And then she was stuck in Gaza with her, you know, two U.S. citizens stuck there, you know, with expired passports. And, you know, the U.S. government, you know, wasn't particularly helpful. So yeah, that was another story that I had previously covered. And yeah, I guess originally we wanted to follow up, you know, see who's actually able to get in. We were looking at, you know, children being allowed into the U.S. For medical treatment. And yeah, eventually just decided to look at a bunch of different immigration kind of nightmares that people were facing, you know, after finally managing to get out of Gaza, which already is a very limited number of people. Like people were then having to deal with a whole new bureaucratic nightmare, just trying to find safety here or elsewhere. So yeah, I spoke to a couple of people who were turned away at the border, you know, after having the U.S. embassy help them evacuate from Gaza with their children. You know, one family I spoke to, they again had a child that was a U.S. citizen, and the U.S. embassy in Cairo helped them get a visa for their other child who's not a U.S. citizen, and they had valid visas. And when they landed in the U.S., they were sent to secondary screening and separated. The two parents were separated and interrogated for 24 hours. And the mom says she was basically like kind of almost like trapped, or she was like repeatedly invited to apply for asylum, even though she had no intention of applying for asylum. They have family here, and they just wanted to sort of, you know, spend a couple months here, expecting that the war would wrap up within a couple of months, and then they'd go back home. And you know, after, you know, being kind of interrogated and pressured to apply for asylum, she said, okay, yeah, fine, sure. Yeah, she just thought maybe that would be a way for her to be able to, you know, enter the country for a couple of months and be reunited with her husband. And as soon as she said yes, the immigration officer, you know, became really enraged and basically threatened to throw her husband in prison and separate her from her kids if she applied for asylum. And then told her that her husband had requested to be deported to Jordan, where he had citizenship. And so she said she would like to retract her asylum claim, you know, in order to be like reunited with her husband. And then when she was reunited with him for like 1 minute before he was deported, he said, that's not true. I never requested to be deported to Jordan. So she felt like she was basically tricked into applying for asylum and then requesting to cancel the asylum claim, which basically would mean that she wouldn't be able to apply for asylum in future, because that would be considered, the immigration attorney who I spoke with, who had filed a complaint on her behalf, said that the fact that she had tried to apply for asylum and then retracted it could be used as evidence to undermine her credibility in any future asylum claims. So it's like this kind of trap, like you finally make it out of Gaza, you're interrogated at the border, you're like invited to seek asylum, and then when you finally say yes, that's used against you to, you know, threaten to separate you from your kids, and then also prevent you from ever applying for asylum again. It's just like this kind of surreal situation where, like, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know what the correct way to proceed even could be.
Well, you're speaking about this legal limbo that has played out in many contexts around the world for Palestinians across the globe dealing with legal regimes that don't recognize the humanity of Palestinians. And it also brings up this very important point to just underline that I heard many times recording voices in Lebanon or Syria or Jordan where Palestinians were seeking to have full citizenship rights, not because they didn't want to return to Palestine, of course, but because of the lack of daily rights people can't access due to the fact that they're not a citizen, access to certain services or employment. And it brings up this larger question of dehumanization that plays out at various levels. And having your perspective and insights around your reporting, Isabel, in relation to these cases in the United States, I think is important to lift up in relation to understanding the interconnections between Palestine solidarity and migrant justice. So thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was a conversation with Isabel Doucette, who is a journalist based in the Bay Area. Isabel reports for The Guardian and other outlets, and recently has done an important series looking at the realities of the intersection of anti-Palestinian racism in the context of genocide in Gaza and how that intersects with migration control in the United States and the reality of Palestinians as stateless people trying to claim asylum. Thank you, Isabel, for being on the program today. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up on your podcast streaming platforms. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.